So let me introduce Dr. Brad Sachs, a family psychologist who wrote in Psychology Today that parents often are puzzled when it comes to their young adults' hesitancy to take on certain basic grown-up responsibilities.
Yes.
And, well, Brad, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate
it. My pleasure.
Okay. Now, what are some of the ways in common you can ask it.
I can ask it? Okay.
Yeah, sure.
Brad, first of all, I want to commend you on your article. I think it's terrific. And I just want to quote you to you. You say that some parents share with you a certain measure of ambivalence when it comes to maintaining their young adult children. They'll say they don't mind being of service. They say, I want her to be able to focus on college without having to worry about anything else, or he's got plenty on his plate now that he started working. I don't mind giving him a hand. But then on the other hand, there are parents who express frustration, like when I was her age, I was already taking care of this kind of thing by myself.
So let me ask Brad, so what are some of the most common ways adult children rely on their parents for help?
Well, it's complicated because there's the practical issue of what needs to be subsidized, what needs to be underwritten. The economy now is very different than the economy was when parents of young adults were young adults themselves, and certainly different than it was two generations ago. So a lot of times parents of young adults have difficulty acknowledging that times have changed and the economy is just different. On the other hand, there's the kind of ancient and eternal calculus that every parent has to struggle with, which is, to what extent am I supporting and promoting my young adult child's growth? And to what extent might I be stymieing or thwarting their growth with my efforts to make things easier for them? And a third issue that's complicated is that parents sometimes have a hard time feeling less relevant and less necessary. And so sometimes parents will err in the direction of keeping themselves central in their children's lives, sometimes financially, because it's scary or fearsome or worrisome to feel less necessary and to be nudged into the twilight of insignificance, which is the nature of family life and family development.
That's a very interesting take. Brad, Michael and I have adult children who frankly are doing fine on their own. Do you have adult kids?
We do. We have three adult children and grandchildren as well.
Uh-huh. And how has that been for you and your wife as far as your children have been? Did you let them go off on their own or did you help them get launched?
Well, for every parent, it's a combination. And, you know, it's the unsolvable equation of parenthood. You know, to what extent do you step in and offer assistance? To what extent do you step back and allow them to find their own way? The threshold between holding them and holding them back is sometimes a very gauzy threshold. So obviously there's dozens, if not countless, variables and factors that affect the extent to which a parent should or would or could support and promote the growth of their young adult child. But ultimately, you're not done with the job of parenting until your children are self-reliant and self-sufficient.
Or ever, Brad.
Well, yes. We never stop worrying.
That's
always there. But at a sort of functional level, you know, our job is to promote their self-reliance, their autonomy, and their independence. And sometimes well-intentioned parents or parents who are worried about, you know, being nudged towards irrelevance or to the sideline have a difficult time setting limits or establishing what's reasonable and what isn't reasonable in terms of what they offer to subsidize or to underwrite.
You are listening to The Psychiatry Show. I'm Dr. Michael Aronoff, your host. My guest co-host this week is my wife, Dara Wells, and our guest expert on the phone is Dr. Brad Sachs, and we are talking about, well, the weaning process of getting your adult children launched into life, and how much is too much, how much is not enough, and our phone number for your calls, because a lot of us, everybody with a family, has to wrestle with this to one extent or another. Our phone number is 1-877-698-3627. That's 1-877-NYU-DOCS. Or on our email address is docs@SiriusXM.com for your questions, observations, comments, questions that you might have for Dr. Sacks. Give us a call. Brad, there, one thing that does come to mind is this weaning process, and the choices that you make for your children are also issues that you have to be aware of for yourself. The weaning process is a two-way street. Parents are affected by it, and children are as well.
And can we talk about it in practical terms, Brad? You talk about doing a chart. One segment is what the parent's responsible for, one segment is what the child is responsible for, and the third segment is what you're both responsible for. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that's often a little exercise that I use to help crystallize this issue for families, whether or not the young adult is part of the session or not, whether mm-hmm. or not it's just the parents in the session. But it's a little bit like a Venn diagram. You know, one circle would be what the young adult at this stage of life is entirely responsible for. One would be what the parents are entirely responsible for. And one circle would be what there is still some cooperation or negotiation or collaboration. But one of the things that I do with that exercise is I ask the family to do that Venn diagram a year ago, how things uh-huh. work, to do the Venn diagram in the present, and also, and most importantly, to envision what they would like the Venn diagram to look like in the future. Because family life is evolution. You know, that's how we've learned to adapt as we evolve.
Right, and that's what Michael was talking about in terms of the weaning process, right, Brad?
Yeah, and it's a very complicated process. And, you know, a lot of times we're talking specifically about money or fiscal underwriting mm-hmm. or subsidizing, mm-hmm. but, you know, money is a stand-in for countless other aspects of human existence. It symbolizes freedom, it symbolizes power, it symbolizes affection, it symbolizes love. So even if we're talking just on a financial dimension, helping the family be in conversation with each other about how they would like family life to evolve and how autonomy and independence are going to ultimately be perceived and achieved, that's a collaborative discussion. And the more that families can engage in that discussion, because sometimes it's hard to, we still have taboos about talking about money in our culture, even, and that sometimes gets in the way of these conversations being productive ones.
Listeners, if you have an adult child who is leaning pretty heavily on you, give us a call, 1-877-698-3627. That's 1-877-NYU-DOCS. You're listening to The Psychiatry Show. I'm Dara Wells. I am the wife of your host, Dr. Michael Aronoff, and we are talking with Dr. Brad Sacks. And we have some phone calls already coming in. Fred in Michigan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. Can you hear me all right?
Sure,
yes,
can.
We can.
Good. Okay, great. So my wife and I are both retired. She has a 37-year-old son who I allowed to come back and live in an apartment in a separate building, but on my property. I've loaned him tens of thousands of dollars. He pays me back sometimes. Mm. He's practically living there rent-free. He's married. His wife works part-time. My question is, you know, and he's lived there for 2 years. I'm trying to get him out. But my wife continues to enable him as she has all his life. She continues to protect him whenever I try to be stern and firm with him. She feels irrelevant because she just recently lost her elderly mother who she was taking care of. She's depressed. She's lost. She's unmotivated. She feels sad about her son. She feels sad that I don't have a relationship with him. She's blaming me for him finally moving out to his dad's house now with all of his luggage. How do I get my wife to let go?
Brad, there's a lot there to unpack, actually. And,
there sure is.
So obviously we want to just mention a precautionary word that we don't have all of the information that would be necessary to make some sort of very specific suggestions here. But you do raise, Fred, a number of questions that can come up not just by you, but from many people, many of our listeners. So what are your suggestions, Brad, or what's your first take on what you hear from Fred?
Well, Fred, I thought that was a very insightful comment you made about your wife's mom. It sounds like she passed recently. Is that what you were saying?
Yes, and she was her caretaker for the last few years of her life, went over there every day. She had a purpose.
Yeah, so, I mean, so much of your wife's identity, it sounds like, was built on the fulcrum of caring for her mother. And I understand this situation. I understand her son is 37, not 17. So there's been a long-standing issue here. But it must be awfully complicated for your wife at this point to remove another fulcrum from her life. You know, she just lost her mother, and that to some extent, it sounds like, was the axis on which her identity was revolving, and that now has come to an end. It would be natural for her to want to keep another fulcrum, in this case, her son, there to balance herself and give her some sense of identity. But as you were saying, it doesn't seem to be promoting his growth and his autonomy. But the amount of grief that your wife must be carrying right now is considerable. You know, grieving the fact that her mother has passed, grieving the fact that her son is not on a path towards self-reliance and not as much of a source of pride as she would like her son to be. So I would think some of the conversation between you and her might be, you know, how do we grieve these losses? How do we come to terms with them? And what other sources of self-regard, of self-worth, of self-assuredness can you find besides being a caretaker?
You know, Brad, I would like you to address something that I think I'm picking up, Fred, and I don't want to read anything too much into what you're saying, but I hear the frustration and maybe a little bit of anger on Fred's part. What suggestions might you suggest to Fred about approaching talk with his wife about his understanding of these dynamics that you're talking about that she's going through with her recent loss or relatively recent loss, and how best to evaluate what the end point might be with her son?
Yeah. Well, the anger, Fred, is legitimate on your part. You're fed up to some extent, and you don't see this as a sustainable or growth-promoting enterprise at this point. I suspect to some extent you might be channeling some of your wife's anger, which you might be disowning because, you know, she cares for her son and she just lost her mom. And you may even be channeling some of her son's anger at himself for not having gained much traction or developed much momentum that's going to propel him in the direction of independence, because you just don't have much self-respect as a 37-year-old unless you're independent. So the anger is legitimate, but I think in this case the conversation would start with some form of empathy. This must be terribly hard for you to have lost your mom. We only get one mom. It's impossible to overestimate the loss of one's mother, particularly when one has been involved with her. And it would be natural for you to still want to be taking care of your son. But let's take a look at how that's working and how that's going to play out. And let's see what the end game of continuing this kind of awkward, maladaptive arrangement is, because none of you seem particularly happy. So the anger is important, and Michael, I think you're right to pick up on that. I heard that too. Yeah. But the conversation would have to start with some sort of empathy and tenderness about how hard it is for your wife.
Fred, I'm going to go out on a limb, and I totally agree with what Brad is saying to you. I think it is really important because of one other very human quality. If you express your anger as a way of trying to deal with this issue, what you can get in response is a defensiveness on the other person. So that rather than her listening to what your point is, and maybe your very well taken point, she turns a deaf ear to that if she feels defensive, and maybe feels defensive because of what Brad suggested. We're way out in terms of hypothesizing what's going on here, but I think it's important for you to take that into consideration.
Right. And Fred, we want to thank you for the call and wish you luck with your family situation. We're talking with Dr. Brad Sacks, and the topic on the psychiatry show right now is what to do or not to do for your adult children. Give us a call, 1-877-698-3627. That's 1-877-NYU-DOCS. Brad, I want to talk about the word respect. It was used frequently in our last discussion with Fred in Michigan. Mm-hmm. Are adult children disrespecting their parents when they ask for a lot? Is there a fine line between help and taking advantage of a parent?
Well, it's a good question because, you know, to some extent, children at any stage of life can be on the mercenary side. You know, they're going to kind of exploit a situation to whatever extent they can. The problem is that exploiting doesn't lead to much self-regard. And so, you know, the issue is not just respect for the parents. It's an issue of self-respect.
Right.
And when we're constantly leaning on other people, particularly when we become adults, we don't have much self-respect. And that sometimes then comes out as or reveals itself as a lack of respect towards others. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's anything wrong with asking for assistance, but parents of young adults have to remember that they're entitled to say no at times and to think carefully about what's behind the yes or the no. How much of this is to avoid controversy if I say yes? How much of it is to avoid my own aging and my prospective sense of being less relevant or less necessary? You know, there's a lot behind these less and no's that have to, yeses and no's that have to do with one's self-respect and one's young adult's self-respect.
Right, yeah. And too many yeses can sometimes hurt the child, right?
Then you're heading into the territory of pampering or coddling or cosseting, or as Fred said, he's concerned his wife was enabling.
Yeah.
You know, every child, every adult, no matter what age or stage, you know, needs some level of support. But, you know, there's the old saying, don't bite the hand that feeds you unless it keeps you from feeding yourself. And sometimes when we're busy feeding, we're actually preventing our child, even an adult child, from learning how to feed him or herself. And you just can't feel much self-assuredness if you can't feed yourself at a certain point.
And so put in another way, it's a phrase I often use, that one of the major jobs of parenting is to teach your children to become the best problem solvers they can be. And that requires allowing this very delicate dance between taking care of them and letting them take care of themselves in some way.
But also, as we were saying earlier, sometimes the young adult is actually trying to take care of his or her parents by still being needy, by still being dependent. That maybe the young adult child has a sense that mom and dad individually or as a couple are not going to do well unless I provide some sort of glue. So that
very interesting. Yeah.
Taking care of each other, it can be cross-generational. Mm-hmm. And that's some of what we do in therapy, obviously, is we try to tease those invisible loyalties, those invisible processes to the surface. Many, many young adults I've talked to who appear to be under-functioning and even uncaring towards their parents will confide or confess to me that they're actually trying to take care of their parents, albeit in a terribly maladaptive way, by being dependent, by being necessary, by giving them something to focus on. That was the heartbreak of Fred's wife's mom's passing, is all of a sudden, who am I if I don't have a mom? Who am I if I don't have someone to take care of? And as parents, you know, we invest tremendous energy and time and psychic resources into raising our children. To have that come to an end is a fearsome prospect. And many children sense that in their parents and might inadvertently, unintentionally, half consciously, subconsciously continue to give their reason, their parents reasons to have an existence and some meaning or purpose.
Well, let me change the focus just a little bit for advice that you might have for parents who are dropping off young adults at college.
Oh, we know one.
And we happen to know some of our daughters are in those, in that position. Any suggestions there?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the college transition, it's such an interesting, complicated, kaleidoscopic transformation for the entire family. I mean, when a child departs for college, whether it's the oldest child or the last child or any child, you know, it's a significant transformation for everyone in the family. It happens to everyone, even though only one of the family members is leaving. And it reminds me a little bit of the immigration experience. You know, when you're an immigrant, you got to decide what to leave behind and what to take with you as you kind of reconstitute your identity on a different shore. And that's exactly what is so challenging. But of course, as we were saying earlier, it's challenging for the parent too, because they have to decide how to reconfigure and recalibrate, retitrate their role, their relationship with their departing child. And that takes some time, and it takes some experimentation, and it's trial and error. I always encourage parents and seniors or whoever is about to depart for college to have conversations about what kind of contact do you envision having with each other? Do you intend to text every day? Do you intend to call once a week? You know, how will we still be in relationship to each other, even if we're not living together, even if there's not day-to-day contact? And just the act of asking the young adult that question is a way of respecting them, is a way of recognizing.
I want to try and get this email in, Brad. Lori says she has three adult children, two of which have children of their own. Recently, my husband and I decided it was time to downsize and sell the family house and move into a nearby apartment. Both my sons are very supportive and agree. But my daughter, on the other hand, is very spiteful. She claims her children have too many memories in the house and that's their sanctuary, yet they barely ever come over. We've helped my daughter and her family over the years with her children, even giving her money. Both my husband and I are very hurt by my daughter's reaction. It's putting a damper on what should be a happy moment. We're starting to feel like we've done too much for her, and she takes us for granted. I'm not sure how to repair the relationship. I'm not sure how to let it not affect us enjoy this next chapter. Please help.
Again, a rather small challenge, Brad, for you.
in the few minutes we have
begin. Left. Where to begin? Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of angles of entry.
Right.
You know, I guess I'm going to go back to that grief theme that we were talking about with Fred earlier, that for whatever reason, the writer's daughter is experiencing considerable grief and almost wants time to stand still. She doesn't go over to the parents' house all that much, it sounds like, but the fact that the parents are moving on means the time is moving on.
Yes.
And time only moves in one direction. You know, you can't turn back the clock. So there's something about the daughter's grief that for whatever reasons her sons are not experiencing that's kind of getting in the way there. Something about letting go, wanting to create or recreate some sort of idealized childhood. You know, the parents obviously have every right to move on and to create the next chapter in their life, in their lives. But something about the daughter's response suggests that there's some unresolved or unaddressed hurt or longing or yearning. And that might be, you know, kind of the more fundamental discussion for them to have. They're entitled to move on. The daughter's entitled to be unhappy. But what's that unhappiness about? And what are the fears or worries that lie behind it? That's what I would be curious about.
So is this the kind of suggestion, and I think we're going to have to leave it at this, that you would suggest really some sort of neutral third-party professional to help facilitate that kind of discussion, because it's not easy.
Yeah, these conversations are very hard, and that's why sometimes it's helpful to have a therapist, a facilitator, some objective conduit, who can promote and broker this very complicated and painful conversation. There's probably volumes of stories behind the daughter's feelings about this move, and helping the parents understand those stories, helping the daughter to tell those stories because she may not even be aware of it. That can often be the best route towards healing, towards reconciliation, and to forestalling or precluding, preventing, some sort of rupture that might be very painful for everybody as this transition takes place.
Brad, thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to Dr. Brad Sacks. He's a family psychologist and the author of Emptying the Nest: Launching Your Young Adult Toward Success and Self-Reliance. I really appreciate you joining us. And, although we've just scratched the surface of the issue, I think we've done it, I think we've done it a good service. So, again, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. I think we scratched well.